Hey gang, I'm here to talk to you about something super important, and that is underpants. Chances are you're probably wearing underpants right now. And if you are, have I got some news for you. With smart design, premium fabrics, and a simple shopping experience, Mack Weldon underwear is definitely better than whatever you're currently wearing. In addition to looking and feeling great, all Mack Weldon products are crafted with natural fibers that have built-in performance capabilities, so they're working as hard as you're working. And they even have a line of silver underwear and shirts that are naturally antimicrobial, which means they eliminate odor. I hope I pronounced that word correctly. Microbial. They do all that. And you can have Mack Weldon underwear shipped right to your door. If you don't like your first pair, you can keep it, and they'll still refund you. So, no questions asked. You get a free pair of underpants. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your purchase using the promo code MOVIECLUB. Once again, go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your purchase using the promo code MOVIECLUB. Hey, everyone, I want to tell you about something cool here at Earwolf. Chris Gethard's podcast, Beautiful Stories from Anonymous People, just put out a very special episode with a guest co-host, Katie Couric. Chris and Katie talk to a queer caller going through one of the most meaningful and stressful changes in their life. This call is really going to surprise you. Beautiful Anonymous is the show where Chris Gethard takes anonymous phone calls. The show's been featured on This American Life, and it's really fun. Subscribe to Beautiful Stories from Anonymous People in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Welcome to the Cracked Movie Club. I'm Abe Epperson.
I'm Tom Ryman.
And we're Cracked Movie Experts. Yeah. So we're here to tell you some neat behind-the-scenes details about your favorite films. For the next hour, hold on to your butts while we dissect 2008's The Hurt Locker, directed by Catherine Bigelow.
I have no idea why it's hold on. I think it's because I copy-pasted the Jurassic Park timeline.
No, I added that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That was my, I just want to, you know, like have it catch,
big
hold on to your butts.
To do yeah. with that.
Just, they're yeah, always well, in perennial danger.
It was more about like your favorite films and like, we're like, you know, we have.
I gotcha. Yeah.
Jurassic Park-y.
Trying to slide.
Type.
Okay. It was
it.
So effective.
Yeah.
That
you smiled.
You tricked me.
You smiled.
You tricked me into thinking that I had screwed something up.
Yeah. We're having fun here.
Yeah. So it's a new director, Catherine Bigelow. And interestingly, September is Women Director Awareness Month.
Yeah.
You can go to directedbywomen.com. It's a organization that's been holding a international viewing fest, I think.
No.
Worldwide,
yeah.
Worldwide film viewing party from
is.
The 1st to the 15th. So you can go to that website and check them out. You can also follow them on Twitter at Directed by Women. And this was just a happy accident.
Yeah,
we in no way planned this.
Yeah, it was mentioned to us, and we were like, we wanted to make sure that we had a female director up top.
Yeah.
So in month three, we were like, Catherine Bigelow. She's
Catherine
got a lot
Bigelow,
of good
yeah,
ones. And we're also having, next weekend, we're having a... at the UCB Sunset Theater in
It'll be
LA.
This weekend, actually, when this airs, right?
Well, this weekend, yeah.
So, yeah.
You're absolutely right.
So,
you're listening to this on Thursday. On Saturday, we'll be in LA. But, yeah, we'll be talking about Point Break with Soren Bowie and Carmen Angelica. But today, along with us is our guest, Adam Ganzer, who's director of videos at Cracked. Before we begin, Adam, please give us a synopsis of the film, as you remember.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
Oh, wait. When did you see it the first time, I guess?
Oh, yeah. When's your first time?
You know, I saw Hurt Locker probably after the Academy Award.
Really?
Yeah, I did. Because war movies have... I'm kind of hit and miss with war movies. Like, I still haven't seen Dunkirk, even though I do like Christopher Nolan. Because, you know, they often feel repetitive. And I'm pleased to say this one is not. Like, Hurt Locker is not a repetitive movie, like film, like war movie compared to a lot
yeah,
of the
it's
other
pretty,
ones.
It's pretty unique.
It is unique. Mm-hmm. And also because sometimes I'm a sucker for stars with war movies, and this one didn't have any.
Purposely so. We'll
yeah,
get
purposely
into that.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's an excellent film, and I so probably 2009, whenever the Academy Award was it 2010?
It was 2010.
Yeah.
So right around after that, probably.
Yeah. It actually came out internationally in 2008. But it was up for the 2009 awards because it released in the U.S. in 2009.
In late 2009?
I think it was spring, summer.
But, yeah, okay. That's the reason why it was up for, even though it technically has the date 2008, it was up against, like, Avatar and,
yeah.
like, for the award ceremony.
Well, and funny enough, we were both in film school at that time. In fact, we were on a movie together. Abe
yes,
and
we
I,
were.
Back during that time. And we were... really busy for like that entire like 6 month
yeah, that's
stretch.
Right. That's
it was
right.
crazy. So that's maybe another reason why I didn't watch it. Because
oh yeah,
you're busy.
I didn't watch
in my
any movies.
Glory. Yeah, no, That's well, good to know.
Yeah.
Hit us with your synopsis.
I was gonna say I was unemployed during that stretch, so I watched it.
Yeah, it seems like the Hurt Locker meant a lot to all of us, really. okay, yeah. So the Hurt Locker is the story of when the leader of an elite bomb defusion unit is killed, his two squad mates must finish their tour of duty with one of the most gifted defusion experts in the armed services, Sergeant William James. The problem is Sergeant James is also an action addict with a death wish, and he's the one giving the orders.
Mm.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it a lot. It's effective, efficient.
Very, very good.
It's just got Ganza written all over it.
Well, that's like a solid back of the box summary.
Yeah, that's a good sum up. On this show, we like to compare your plot description to a few of our own rudimentary summaries. Feel free to join us on our segment, Terrible Loglines.
A man desperately tries to avenge a young Iraqi boy, only to realize he was just being racist.
True.
Yep.
If we believe what he says, Iraqi boy named Beckham has the world's greatest DVDs.
An enthusiastic bomb squad aficionado colonel finally finds his wild man.
A heroic bomb expert fails to disarm a single bomb when anyone's life is actually in danger.
That's true.
The U.S. Army refuses to discontinue its two-wheeled wagon bomb diffusion program. Dozens die.
Hawkeye feeds Falcon Capri Suns in the desert.
The Falcon considers murdering his fellow sergeant for getting his lost gloves.
That's true. Two horrible soldiers somehow achieve the rank of colonel in the United States military service.
British Ray Fiennes gets shot by sniper fire, becoming yet again an English patient.
Well, solid.
Now,
solid pull.
Thank you. Now that you know the plot, let's dive into the making of the movie from pre-production to post-production in a segment we like to call Expensive Pretending.
Mm.
So tell us about the script then, Tom.
Okay, well, the movie was written by Mark Boal, who was a journalist, a freelance journalist. He had spent a couple of weeks embedded with an EOD squad in Baghdad, and that's how he developed this script. He just spent a lot of time around the explosive core of
the EOD squad.
The EOD squad.
Yeah.
And just saw how they did things and what their day-to-day life was like, and he felt like it would be an interesting opportunity to present people with something that you don't see anything about. Like, you never hear about this kind of army operation on the news.
It's
and
true.
Yeah.
They're always in remove anyway, because it's like they come in when everyone else is left.
Right. You hear about IUDs when they blow up and kill soldiers. That's
right.
When you hear about them. You don't hear about what these guys do.
But,
and the characters, the main character, I mean, all the characters are just kind of like amalgamations of all the people he talked to.
Right.
That makes sense. It is the right thing to focus on for the Iraq war, though.
Absolutely,
because
yeah.
It does feel like the only news in America that we got about that war as it was ongoing was like bombs blowing up that were like hidden. You know, so it was like the perfect thing.
IUDs, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
When the movie takes place in 2004, I believe.
Yeah,
and I remember that's all over the news. Like every day you hear about IUDs.
Yeah, it was the perfect subject matter. Also, Mark Boal is like a child. I don't know how old that guy is, but I can't believe that he got that gig over there.
Yeah, when I saw a picture of him, I was stunned.
Exactly.
I was like, what?
He's a child. Like, I don't even think he was 30 when he got this gig. It was right. Like, how did he get embedded? Then 2 weeks over there, you know, like, that's not that much time.
It's not
and then
that
he
much
writes
time.
This great screenplay.
Right,
this guy's a Mensa, man.
Soldiers talk about how it's, while it's not terrible in its depiction of warfare and soldiers during, you know, wartime, they do point out inconsistencies.
Yeah.
For example, a lot of people are wearing incorrect uniforms. There's a lack of radio communications throughout all of it.
Yeah.
Where, like, people would be mm-hmm. in touch that weren't.
It's a specific plot point.
And
James takes off his
He takes
radio.
Off his, you know, and specifically how misbehavior is treated by the Army.
The uniform thing, I grew up in a military family. The uniform thing is a strangely pervasive problem. Like movies and TV shows rarely get uniforms correct.
Didn't Generation Kill go out of its way to get it right?
I'm not sure.
Because I want to say that's that David Simon produced short
The Wire,
miniseries.
The creator of The Wire later made a miniseries.
And
if there was
Generation
a person
Kill.
To do it, I would imagine he would be the one.
Yeah.
Right?
And if I'm not mistaken, when the Iraq war started, the soldiers didn't all have the correct uniforms. Like there wasn't enough of them. So some of them had to be deployed with like desert gear like helmets and legs and stuff, but not the right.
Yeah.
Whatever, the chest piece, you know, whatever you call that.
I seem to remember that headline where it was like shared with predictable incredulity, like the soldiers don't have enough uniforms.
Exactly. Right. I remember it being a news story, yeah. Which is to say people over here really care about that. So it's a bummer that it wasn't right in this movie. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's the sort of thing that your average moviegoer doesn't notice. And the like, I feel like, obviously, I understand their complaints because it was always a bummer watching Top Gun with my dad. Because he was a naval aviator, so he just fucking ruined that movie.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah, but like the uniform thing and like the radio contact thing, those are things you do in service of the story.
Yeah.
Very often in like in a movie when they present you with like a dramatic situation or like in a horror movie or something where they like just call the police or something. It's just a deliberate choice that you make,
right,
to like
you
to make the
characters
more isolated and
making it like verisimilitude, like making it feel authentic
and giving you the movie experience, right? Like,
right,
like where tension,
because it is a movie,
stays. Yeah, right. And I think a pretty well scripted one. You know, I've seen it several times now, and this time when I watched it in prep for this podcast, it stood out how tight it is. Mm-hmm. Like it's a really tight, it doesn't fool around kind of movie, and it's very small in a lot of ways.
Which is, it's episodic.
Yes.
There's not really a narrative. Like the only narrative is there's the countdown. This is how much time is left in Bravo Company's rotation.
Like there's no
character.
Yeah, that's
right. It's about the characters.
Like most movies, Sergeant James's character would have a clear want that then he tried to achieve.
And something would snap back at him.
Yes.
Story.
And he would overcome it, right? Or whatever. This is not that kind of movie. It's more like peeling an onion layer back until he becomes cognizant of a thing that we're seeing before he sees it about himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. It's a journey of him discovering and accepting who he is.
Which is interesting, you know? Because who he is, Staff Sergeant James, one of the biggest gripes of ex-military and military people who watch the film is he would never have that job. He's self-defined as like a cowboy type. That's exactly the opposite of what that job
totally
would be. You have to be cold, collected. I mean, not cold, but just like you have to be very
cool.
Cool-headed.
Well, he's also, I mean, forgive me for using this analogy, but he's sort of the auteur of bomb diffusers, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's allowed to be eccentric, and he's allowed to, like, do all these bananas things
because
of how great he is.
The first thing we see is Colonel David Morse shitting his pants about him.
Well, and, like,
this guy's the best!
Yeah, he's got fans. He's got bomb diffusion fans, which is, like, okay, that's fine. But more than that, like, he's allowed to basically be a cowboy and do things that put everybody else in danger because he seems to be the only one that will always survive. Like, no matter what, he's going to defuse this bomb somehow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's, to me, what he's really wrestling with in some ways is, like, is there a bomb I can't defuse? You know?
Yeah.
Like, that's a real question for him. And we find out that there is.
And I think that's part of the conceit of the movie. It's like, well, what if there was this guy?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
He's magic in some ways, for sure.
Oh, sure.
You know?
He's absolutely magic.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, he's Bomber Man. Interesting note, it was James Cameron who convinced his ex-wife to direct it.
Catherine Bigelow?
Yeah, Catherine Bigelow. She had planned on doing a different project and wasn't sure about doing the film. Cameron read it and told her to do it, and it ended up earning her the Oscar for Best Director. By the way, because of the year thing that we were talking about earlier, it beat out Avatar.
Yeah.
So
he was back right behind her at the Academy Awards.
Exactly.
With his insane hair.
Rightly so.
Yeah.
Fuck Avatar.
Yeah, no.
Well,
Avatar's not nearly...
It was everybody felt like it was Bigelow's year. That was definitely the conversation surrounding that Academy Awards. Was like Bigelow's going to win, and then like James Cameron is getting this nod, but he's never going to win an Academy Award again because of the "I'm the King of the World" speech. Like Hollywood hates him so much because of that.
In fact, as you mentioned, it had a small domestic box office gross,
right?
$12 million. That's the lowest grossing Best Picture winner to ever exist.
Yeah, even Moonlight made more money than that.
Yeah.
Right.
In fact, Best Picture winners from the 60s have outgrossed it. It was a real sleeper.
Yeah.
It was a real sleeper.
Yeah, it was a small film, which is interesting because at this point in Bigelow's career, she hadn't done a major studio film in, I think, 8 years, something
that.
Yeah. Her last movie had been K-19, The Widowmaker, which is a movie where Harrison Ford plays a Russian. Let that
submarine
just course through your body.
Yeah.
It's not a bad movie.
It's okay, yeah.
It just, but it bombed, and you know, we're gonna have to talk about the gender politics of Hollywood.
We should.
We,
yeah.
We have to.
Yeah, we should.
It's a deal.
And I think, I mean, there's probably other factors that we can't know that are at play, but it's hard to ignore the fact that male directors will get many more chances to do a studio film, and she just didn't.
It's, I mean,
and right. we, I mean, we don't
even
know.
Even though she had proven herself with Point Break.
Yeah, her filmography is so good leading up to that. Like, and it's interesting films, too, that performed up to that point. So, and she's married to James Cameron. It's
briefly, it was 89, like
that's
the beginning
fair,
of the 90s.
But he's still an advocate for her, you know, and you don't mean to, I don't mean to and say think, that's the only thing that matters, but we all understand that, like, Hollywood is a little bit about, like, relationships and alliances, and that would be helpful to
and
her.
And I think that was part of the problem, too. Like, maybe, right before K-19, she did Strange Days. I think that was the last studio picture she did right before K-19. And a lot of her work on Strange Days was overshadowed by Jim Cameron's presence since he wrote the script and produced it with her.
That's interesting.
So he was kind of that. Very often that movie is cataloged as a Jim Cameron movie instead of a Catherine Bigelow movie, and she's the director.
What a bummer. I actually didn't know that because I've only just seen Strange Days and knew she directed it and thought, what a great movie this
is. Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk about it.
Yeah, it's great.
It's such a strange...
It's really cool ideas in it.
Strange movie.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. So maybe James Cameron's just in her way the whole time. Maybe that's the narrative.
I think maybe
there.
That was the... Maybe.
Yeah. I think it's more of a anthemic issue of female directors. And like, you don't get as many chances, just like as you said, Tom. Like, you fail once... And it's a bigger problem than when a male director fails. And that's a problem.
Yeah. And
hands down.
Can I ask a question?
Performing.
Where did you hear that James Cameron convinced her to do this movie? Where did that information come from?
From the internet.
And, right. But I mean, like, because that's interesting to me that would be out in the world. That, like, because that is probably just a private conversation, right?
They're divorcees, they probably I don't know if they've had like a tell-all, but it's there's a lot of details that I found between those two that are like, why do we know that
exactly, because I saw a lot of interviews with Catherine Bigelow in prep for this podcast, and she was pretty careful to make it sound as though the screenplay really captured her imagination. Like, in fact, she had a talking point every single time. She would give a lot of props to Mark Boal, and then she would say, like, these guys, you know, arguably have the most dangerous job in the world, these bomb diffusers, right? Like, that was a talking point. Go watch her interviews. She says it, like, dozens of times. So it's interesting, which is, like sort of log-line-y.
Sure.
But
well,
it's
when
interesting,
you're giving the same interview for the same film,
100%.
You're gonna...
It's marketing.
But it's interesting that this piece of trivia would exist in that, like, she worked so hard in the build-up to the film to make it sound as though it was the only movie that she wanted to make. And instead, now the narrative is that maybe she was talked into it.
Well, I think at this point, she hadn't read it. The point of the trivia is that he was like, check this shit out. And
she
was like, okay. And she read it, and she was like, yeah, that's good.
Huh.
Like, he did some convincing, but ultimately it was just something that I think he passed on.
Hmm.
Like, he was like, I'm not going to do it myself. I'm an Avatar man.
Hmm.
And
he really is.
I'm more of a seven films of Avatar kind of a guy.
He has quadrupled down on I'm an Avatar.
Yeah.
Just fucking Daniel Plainview. I'm an Avatar man. I made a deal with Union.
Not enough fake people in this story.
Yeah.
Looks a little, not enough water.
But the point is, the point of the trivia, though, to me, is that she beat him.
Right.
In best
I agree with that. Yeah. I'm not certainly questioning your sources. I'm more just like thinking about what it means that we know.
Well,
that
it's interesting
piece of
that piece of trivia came out because it's again trying to give man credit for.
Yeah. And Cameron just can't stay out of the way with this issue. Like, because I mean, it's interesting that he would make that point because, again, a couple of weeks ago, he made that comment about Wonder Woman that Patty Jenkins directed that's caused a lot of, an amount of uproar.
Yeah.
And we had to go back and sort of litigate his case for having been a feminist advocate in his filmmaking. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, he has a, I mean, we're talking about him now because he's kind of got his, like, hands around this story still somehow.
Yeah, and listeners, if you're not aware of it, which you know, I doubt
some people
it.
Might not be.
Some people might not be. He came out and he was like, why are we so all about Wonder Woman? Remember, you know, Alien? Remember Sigourney Weaver in that film? Like, so he was like saying how we've already kind of had a first form of like a feminist movement in film, and he wasn't all about just the idea that we should ingratiate these films that have all female casts, or more or less, just because they do. Which I understand from a philosophical point of view, but also I'm like, you're not the guy to do this.
He's also ignoring a lot of things.
And you're ignoring, right. you're cherry picking your details, yeah.
First hugely successful superhero blockbuster, exactly. Starring a woman, directed by a woman.
Right. Like, for sure. Right. Clearly momentous, and he should have known enough to just say nothing.
Yes.
Even if he had a good point to make.
Well, I
mean, he should have said nothing. You know?
What are the two things we know about Jim Cameron? One, he's amazing. Two, he's an asshole.
Right. Yeah. So that he is.
Anyway, we're talking way too much about him.
He should just go down back into the sea. That's what he should do. You want to talk about casting at all?
Yeah. Oh, so related to the budget, Bigelow finally found somebody to finance the film. Who I can't remember. His name is Chartier or something. He's one of the original producers on the film. That gave her like a budget of like, okay, we could maybe do this for like $20 million, but you've got to have some stars in it or else we're never going to recoup that money. But she specifically did not want to have any stars. She wanted to cast all unknowns in the three lead roles because, and it's done very effectively in the finished film, she wanted the audience to never be sure who was going to die.
Yeah.
Or like how safe a character was. And it's done really well because the only recognizable actors we get in the movie are, I mean, outside of David Morse, but you got to kind of be a movie nerd to recognize David Morse. You get Guy Pearce, Ralph Fiennes. And they both die immediately.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
They get like 3 minutes of screen time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like Guy Pearce is it's in the first scene. You see him, you're like, oh, he's in this movie. And then he's dead.
Yeah.
So, and we mentioned, I mean, to go back, it was like a similar strategy in Alien. When they made Alien, Tom Skerritt was the only star that anybody knew.
That's
and they kill him like 40 minutes in. So you're like, fuck, I don't know what's going to happen.
They kill him off screen too.
Yeah.
That's interesting because I also suspect that I'm now going on the theory that she was sort of jilted by the studio system. That's another way to avoid having anybody tell her what to do.
Studio entanglements,
And to have stars who are not of the size that would dictate how the content is made. You know what I mean? Like that's a smart tactic for a director who wants to make a movie on her own terms.
But by sticking to that though, it had the potential to be disastrous.
100%.
They were like, okay, well, if you're going to make it with that cast, we're cutting the budget down to like $20 million and you got to try to shoot it in Morocco.
Plus, Ralph Fiennes had worked with her on Strange Days. So who's kind of not calling in favors, that's not how it works in Hollywood, but just the idea that they were familiar with enough with each other that they could be like, hey, you want to do like 2 or 3 days on this picture?
And I think that came as a compromise. Like
they probably put
Ralph Fiennes and Guy Pearce in the movie. It's like, okay, well, you got these guys who people at least know who Ralph Fiennes is.
Right.
So we have a star.
Yeah. Although, I think you have to be honest, like they're not stars. They don't drive any kind of real traffic to movies.
No.
They just make it feel like it's a real movie because I know that face.
But you see him.
Yes.
And you attach to him immediately. Like, okay, I know this person, I can focus on this person. And unless you were a huge fan of, like, National Lampoon's Senior Trip or 28 Weeks Later, you have no fucking clue who Jeremy Renner is.
Yes. I think he was in Dahmer before this, right?
That's why she cast him.
Yeah, right. She was like, I like the cut of his jib.
Specifically because James is crazy. You're not supposed to know whether or not he's heroic or if he's a psychopath.
Yeah.
He gives an amazing performance in this movie, I would say.
He's real good.
And this is the beginning of the Renaissance.
This really put him on the map.
Yeah. Adam and I were talking about this before the podcast. I think the three leads are all really good. Adam disagrees on one point, but I definitely think specifically Jeremy Renner and Anthony Mackie are really great in this movie.
Yeah,
I don't think there's any dispute about those two. I didn't love the younger...
Eldridge.
Yeah.
And not because I think it was bad, but because maybe it might be a writing problem too. I felt like that character was a little weak to be on the front. You know, like that seemed problematic. Now, especially in a movie that's not like Platoon or some movie like that where it's like they were drafted. You know, like this is like
you didn't buy that scene where he's in like after he's gotten shot and he's in the helicopter and he's like, fuck you, man.
No, that was a great scene because at that point you're really invested in his journey because you're worried for him the whole time.
Yeah,
I was.
Yeah.
And I think you make this point. Well, I don't want to steal this from you. I just thought that the actor felt a little bit available in a way that seems like a soldier couldn't be.
I think that's intentional.
I agree.
Well, yeah.
See, because Renner, every little tick that he does feels like layers and layers of scars built to this man. You know what I mean? Like he's been traumatized right. or broken somewhere down the line that led to this, you know?
To prepare for the film, Renner actually spent a week living and training at Fort Irwin, which yeah. is a U.S. military reservation in the Mojave Desert. He was taught to use C4 explosives, learned how to render safe improvised explosive devices. So he went through the training somewhat. And he also, you know, obviously wearing a bomb suit. So he had to go through training for this just to get, like, just to get prepared for the role, which I thought was kind
yeah,
of cool.
Get some authenticity.
Or notable.
I mean, that suit's got to be 100 pounds,
it's
right?
Like, I think it's 85 to 100 pounds. Is that what it is? Depending yeah. on what gear
oh,
he's wearing.
We're researched here, Adam. we know
it's heavy
how
as hell.
Many.
It's a cool suit.
It looks so heavy.
85 to 100.
It's a suit of armor.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I thought one of the strongest things in the movie from a directing point of view was the moment that he puts on the bomb suit the first time and walks out to, instead of using the robot, because he walks way more easily in that suit.
Suit, yeah.
Than
he's at comfort.
And then his predecessor,
then Guy
who
Pierce,
like lumber,
yeah.
yeah, Guy Pierce, who sort of lumbers
he's
around
in like an astronaut.
Exactly.
Yeah, like he looks super cool when he pulls out like the 9mm and pointing it at the taxi. Like he, it's like seamless. Like he really seems like he's at comfort in that suit, which is kind of a plot.
Yeah,
It's well executed on a directing front because it's a small thing that you get a lot from.
In fact, something that Tom pulled, which I thought was interesting, was that they had an AC built into it.
Oh.
Because they're in Jordan and it's like 120 yes. degrees. But they couldn't run it because it created
noise,
too many noise.
Yeah.
Well, Abe and I, this is a small bit of trivia that I think you'll like. Abe and I, at this movie we referred to in 2009 that we were working on instead of watching The Hurt Locker, was about a gorilla. Now,
go on.
So we tried to get a real gorilla suit. And by that I mean one of the ones that was made from like Congo. Or whatever.
It's funny
right?
that those are classified as real gorilla suits.
Well, this is why they're real. This is why they're real. Because they have to have massive cooling units in them. Because they're so hot that an actor can die. And that means that they're like very expensive. They cost like 10 to 20 grand a day to rent. And then you have to have like several wranglers who make the cooling system work. And animatronic stuff for the face. So needless to say,
multiple
that didn't
texts.
Happen in our student yeah. film that we were making. Uh-huh. But we did work with a person who basically just did the gorilla suit without the air conditioning unit. And we had to take breaks, what would you say, every 30 minutes?
Yeah, probably.
Every 30 minutes and put this guy under fans or else he'd get heat stroke.
They did that for Renner, too.
Exactly.
It was every 15 or 20 minutes they would have to open up the visor and put cold, wet washcloths on his face.
And that shit's no joke.
Yeah.
That shit is no joke because, like, it's dangerous and it's you can't do it for very long.
Mm.
Like, the actor that we got, slowly our relationship with him deteriorated over time for exactly this reason, that cooling
right.
off an actor.
He just hated being on set.
Yeah, and I think that Renner is pretty pro because I don't know how he didn't flip out in a suit like that.
He might have. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe he did and we just don't know
There's
about
no
it.
There's stories that I saw.
Yeah, well, at least they managed not to make it leak, you know?
Very true.
Yeah. yeah.
So we mentioned they filmed this in Jordan, which is right on the Iraq border.
Right.
And that's because Catherine Bigelow wanted to get as close to the fighting as she could. She wanted to film in Iraq, but that was impossible because of
yeah.
safety concerns. So she got as close as they could,
yeah.
and they filmed it in freaking summer in Ugh. Jordan. So it's 120 degree heat. Jeremy Renner's wearing an extra, almost another person as he's making
oh, yeah.
100 pounds.
And the scene, I had read an interview with Anthony Mackie where he was talking about the scene where it's him and Jeremy Renner doing the sniper, where they're laying down in the desert. And he was like, he said like that was literally hell because it was a week of shooting almost. And all the flies
all
you
the
see
flies.
On them, those are not added. Those are just in the desert. They're boiling. You know, it's just a grueling shoot.
It makes you want to be, it makes you want to be in the room when they made the decision to do that. And hear how strongly the person who is arguing for, but what about the heat, was heard, right? Because, like, you have to be willing to sort of turn your ears off a little bit
yeah.
to make a decision like that.
Because
mm-hmm. when you're there, you would not do it again. There's no way you would do it again if you're sitting in that heat. You're like, this was a bad decision no matter what. I hate this.
There was they also, just because of the logistics of where they were shooting, there are no trailers.
Yeah, so no one, you didn't have a break from the
they had tents. Heat. That's it. They had tents, no air conditioning. So the best you could do was get some shade from a tent.
Well, plus they're running around with handheld cameras too, right? So you have these guys lugging around.
The film was shot with 4 16mm handheld cameras.
Yeah. Super 16. So it was not shot on 35.
So they're probably not as heavy.
And Barry Aykroyd, who's the cinematographer of the film, the DP, actually became sick at one point with heat stroke. Not to mention that Renner himself tripped and fell down some stairs at one point. So they had to stop shooting for a week, which a lot of people in the crew were like, I think this is, we're done.
Because it was so problematic.
And then they, you know, a week later they were shooting because he couldn't walk.
Wow.
I think that's the scene where he carries
the Iraqi boy
out of the building as he fell down those stairs and twisted his ankle.
But he healed and they went back at it. But it was just such a plagued shoot.
It was a 44-day shoot, 12-hour days, 6 days a week.
Yeah, that's pretty.
That's pretty standard.
But
in the 120-degree heat, though,
no, that's the crazy
desert,
part.
They would give a little bit more of charity in terms of, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
money is money, you know. Like,
and then I want to say Apocalypse Now and movies like that that went off to shoot on location in places like that, they just spent a lot more money.
That's
to
funny.
Be able to do it.
It's funny you mention that because the amount that they shot, they had a 100-to-1 expended film ratio. What that means is that they wasted, like, not wasted, but like what's in the movie versus what they shot, which is more than Apocalypse Now's ratio, which is known in the industry as the go-to, they shot the most film kind of film. So Bigelow,
she won that record.
For
reference, over 200 hours of footage was shot, which resulted in over a million feet of film.
That's
and it's
one
just because they had, you know, four cameras every scene.
Right. Mm-hmm. I want to say that typically the ratio is something like 10-to-1, right? Where it's like sort of it's about 10 minutes of footage for every 1 minute of movie.
Yeah.
At least that's what I remember
it
from
seems right.
back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, people shoot differently now because video.
Right.
Because it's all ones and zeros, and it's hard drive space, and that can be free at a certain point.
A little more cavalier you don't with it, then?
Yeah, you don't have to process it. You don't have to, you know, get the work tape, the dailies, all that stuff is all the same stuff, so it's not like you need to print it for every, you know, utility.
So it's still
a lot more of a process.
Like dailies are just like, you just kind of like watch the footage now, right? Because it's all digital.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a lot easier.
You usually encode it to something.
It's not as much of a momentous thing the way that it was when you're shooting film where like everybody sits down and watches the dailies because of the... Because
you had to like go get it because you had no idea what you just saw.
Right.
Yeah.
Now it's a lot more like, I think it's easier to manicure that experience for people who need to watch dailies, if you know what I mean. Like to do more selects and like make less decisions on set, if you will.
Another thing that I thought was interesting in terms of putting the crew in danger is there's import restrictions in Jordan on military props. Because even though it is in Iraq, it's still, you know, in the Middle East.
Sure, it's right on the border.
It's right on the border. So the film's special effects artist, Richard Stutzman, used Chinese fireworks for gunpowder because they couldn't get, like, the real thing. So one day he was assembling a prop, and the heat and the friction caused the fireworks to blow up on his face. 2 days later, he returned to work.
How bad was the blow up?
Can't have been that bad.
He just doesn't have a face now.
I mean, unless he's coming. Yeah, unless he's like Two-Face coming back to work on that shit.
I just think it's interesting. Like they, for an authentic film, because like the bomb disposal outfit worn by Renner was authentic.
Yeah.
The robot we mentioned was actually like a Northrop Grumman counter IED mission robot. Like they're all authentic. They still had to do things like, well, the guns themselves can't fire actual ammunition, so we're going to just make it work somehow and like, you know, rig it together.
So when they fire like the, because I'm assuming those are all prop guns.
Yeah.
So when those are the
blanks.
He just made blanks out of Chinese fireworks.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Instead of the gunpowder.
The idea of this man manufacturing their blanks to save money is like, wow, that's tough for a feature film to be at that level of strapped.
I mean, there's a surprisingly small amount of gunfire in this movie for a war movie. There's only maybe 3 sequences.
Yeah, it's still just one of those things. Like, I mean, again, contrast.
And still, like, if you're making it by hand, I'd still look at that and be like, fuck you, I'm not doing that.
So like, contrast that with a movie like Black Hawk Down.
Mm-hmm. One long firefight.
That's all it is, right?
Yeah.
And It was not quite as haphazard in terms of how it was shot, but it definitely, like, you could not have prop guns the same way that the Hurt Locker does. Like, they, like, those guns have to be more functional because they're in every shot, firing in every shot. You know what I mean? Whereas the Hurt Locker does have the ability to choose when and how you see the gunfire. Like, you could be on a tight here and watch just the gun recoil.
That's true.
And not see the fire of the muzzle and stuff.
Yeah, that's how they're usually fired in the movie.
Yes.
Like, I think the most, I think the 50 cal is one of the big ones. Mm-hmm. And then the sniper rifle, you only see it fire like once, I think.
I don't remember, but
I think it's mostly you're just seeing Anthony Mackie, and then you see him shoot, and it doesn't actually show you like the muzzle.
It's flag. Smart filmmaking, you know. Like,
well, it's an interesting notion, and I think it's intentional. Chris Enos, she was one of the editors, said the raw footage was described as, quote, a hodgepodge of disconnected nausea-inducing motion that was constantly crossing the 180-degree line. Now,
yeah.
A lot of you in the audience don't necessarily know what the 180 line is, and what that is in filmmaking, if you, let's say, we have two subjects, to have two people talking to each other, draw a line through them, and that is your now axis. That means that wherever you put a camera, and it's reverse, so I have a shot of, you know, me, and I have a shot of Tom, you're going to want to place the camera on the same side, because what that does is it makes our eye lines work. It makes it, it just, if you were to watch any film, most of the time, that's just how it does it, because that's just how film grammar has taught us to imbibe cinema. Now, there's reasons to cross the 180 line.
Yeah.
And, you know, Adam, you're a director, and in fact, I've worked on a few pictures with you. That actually you cross the 180 line. Like, explain to me why it would be hard, like, if you're shooting a dinner table scene.
Oh, man.
To follow the 180 line.
The dinner table scene is the hardest.
So, like,
but
there's still several people are
there's still
around
a way,
the dinner table.
There's still a way to maintain the geography of the room, right?
Well, the 180 line, yeah, that's the thing that's crucial, is the 180 line is mostly about making sure everybody knows where they are in the scene, so they're not confused. A dinner table, I mean, you cross the line intentionally for things like to create a sense of emotional jarring. Like, so let's say that somebody got a realization from another person at a dinner table scene, and the whole time you've been shooting this conversation on one side of the line between them. Then, like, one of them finds out, oh, no, my mother died off screen. Then you might cross the line the next time you see that person to give the sense of their disorientation.
It's like
because
a new
you feel disoriented
in the scene.
Exactly. Or sometimes it's to reset emotionally where they are, right? So, like, you move to a new 180 line to say, like, the dynamic has shifted between them and now the camera is going to reflect that.
Right.
But also, frankly, especially in a lot of these handheld-based things or shows like The Shield, the 180 line is becoming less constant in film grammar, I would say. I mean, you know.
And just because I think handheld, and correct me if I'm wrong because I am not a director, like you mentioned The Shield, I'm never confused about what's going on because it's handheld, it's not static, you're seeing the room. So you kind of know where everybody is as the shots shift around. It never, I mean, you can do it to a point where it becomes totally disorienting, but like you see enough of the environment that it's not confusing about where the people are, but it still gives that sense of immediacy or chaos or like things are frenetic. Like it has this energy to it, like this anxious.
There's also mobility in the camera itself, which may lead to that.
I think The Shield is an example of how important editing is. Because I guarantee you that if you watched just the footage of people shooting it across the line, a lot of it wouldn't be usable.
And that's what he was saying. We were saying about the Hurt Locker. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of it's just like nonsense.
I think Bigelow is intentionally doing that to make you feel like a fly on the wall, to make you feel like at any time anything can happen.
That's true.
And you are just—it's a fictional documentary.
Right. Yeah. She came at it with the specific intent to make it look like a newsreel.
Yeah.
She said in an interview that I watched her, it was partly because there was an intimacy to it because the camera's like right up in their face.
Yeah.
And also, I think it's to create the sense of danger is a 360-degree problem in Iraq, right? Like, every single place you look could be the guy who's going to blow you up.
Right.
And that theme is repeated in every single sequence.
And every single cut in this movie is an accusation. Like, every time you cut to a building or to another person who's from Iraq, like, it's an accusation. That person could be the one. It could be them. So, like, that pings you on the racist scale a little bit when you feel those feelings. But also, that's why you need to never feel totally grounded geographically, because you feel the danger every time. You know what I mean? Like that. Yeah. That's the point of it.
Yeah, it's the idea that you're a fish out of water. You are not at home here, and the only person who is Renner's character James, because he's at home in the most dangerous place on the earth to him.
Now, I would say when I watched the movie, I was surprised how little they broke the 180 line in the finished cut. Like you did mostly stay. Or they were pretty good at constantly giving you a new set of geography, like sort of redrawing the line between the
two
characters.
That's interesting, because I had the opposite effect, because screen direction is very spontaneous and sporadic in this film. And by screen direction, I mean like you see a cat and it's walking from right to left, and then it cuts to a different cat and it's walking left to right. Like there's no continuity of motion.
That's
even
true.
Though you're right that like the position of the cameras are often like pretty conventional, the screen direction in the edit is like bombastic and it goes left to right to left, up and down. It's like it doesn't choose where it wants to. It's just shooting in all directions.
I think that's right. I mean, they definitely, screen direction is another way, just for everybody's reference, another way that we talk about the 180 degree line, which is to say that, let's say there was a scene that was happening between me and Tom, and if I was looking to the right of screen, right? So I would be on the left side of screen looking to the right, and he was on the left side of the screen looking to the, no, excuse me, the other one, right?
He was on the right.
He's on the right side looking to the left. This is why it gets confusing.
Yeah.
That you would feel like, oh yeah, they're in a room together,
you
talking
know where
to
they
each
are
other.
In relation
they're looking
to each
at
other.
Each other.
And one of the things that a director often does and debates about, quite frankly, on set is like, are we looking the right way? Like, is the screen direction correct?
Right.
And Bigelow decided to constantly undermine that by where she was choosing to cut to, like, because sometimes she wouldn't cut to the same conversation that you were watching just one frame before. She might cut to another person or to another gun that's pointed from some other place. So screen direction becomes irrelevant because everybody's in the scene all the time.
Yeah.
Everybody's in the scene. You know, it's not just, there's no two-man scenes in that movie except for when they're fighting each other, when they're friends in the barracks, right?
And even then, Eldridge is there, so it's a three-person scene.
Exactly, right. So even when it's just two guys, like, at a sniper range, right? Like, when they're fighting that other sniper guy across the...
Mm-hmm.
This is very technical language.
Other sniper guy.
Yeah, the other sniper guy. Like, everybody else who's anywhere near the vicinity of that battle is in the scene. So every single angle becomes valid because there's no distinct important relationship that she has to constantly cover.
Right.
You know, maybe that's a little complicated.
No, that's exactly right.
It's part of why the movie is so effective.
And why it's always so tense. Because at any moment, somebody could be relevant. Yeah. It's very tense.
And they mixed in a small, it becomes almost part of the score, but it's a small ringing like the edge of tinnitus.
Yes.
And that.
Yes.
The ringing
in your ear.
Which, you know, that's Saving Private Ryan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To be honest, but even before that, there was some films.
There's not a lot of music in this movie, and you don't really notice it ever, I would
say.
Most
of the music
is
it's James is listening to the radio or something. Like
that seems right.
Which is kind of well-trodden area for war films. Like, they usually, you know, like, play on, you know, I mean, I'm just thinking Apocalypse Now,
and
Platoon,
Valkyrie,
you know,
But usually they pick music that's a lot more...
iconic,
I would say broad appeal. Whereas the only song I remember hearing was whatever Metallica or Iron Maiden track that James was listening to, because it was like, whoa, that is a sonic fart in my ear right now. Is what that is.
It's because that's what his character
right,
is
exactly.
A sonic fart in your ear. Well, he's as bombastic as the editing procedure of the film. I wanted to mention in terms of in the post-production and the marketing, in the United States, The Hurt Locker was only one of four Best Picture winners, those being English Patient, Amadeus, and The Artist being the other three, to never enter the weekend box office top five since the top 10 rankings were first recorded in 1982. So it's also one of the only two Best Picture winners on record to have never entered the weekend box office top 10, The Artist being the only other one. So it was no one knew about this film until after the Oscars had happened, to be like, because it always gets a bump, you know, when it wins Best Picture, everyone's like, oh shit, that's a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
It had just not done that well, as we talked about it, $12 million, you know, gross.
How did it end up making its money back?
I don't know.
Actually. It must have.
Right? I didn't do that research, or I couldn't find it.
I remember reading that another part of the problem was as the movie gained buzz, they ran out of prints. mm-hmm. to give to theaters.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
That's how that's, small yeah, this
that's
movie
a
was.
Really Supply bummer demand. Problem.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really bummer problem. Kathryn Bigelow became the first woman to win the Academy Award, the BAFTA, the DGA for Best Director with this film. This was also the first film to win Best Picture that was directed by a woman. At this point, she was the only the fifth one to be nominated.
I think on the surface, there are things that are hard to appreciate about her work here. Like when you see a movie that's shot in such a haphazard way, it's hard to see how meticulously crafted those shots really are.
Right.
But right. I mean, we've sat in the editing room and you know how hard it is to make shooting things like that make sense. It's very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Also just watching her demeanor and how like relaxed she seemed to be. Like, you see this behind the scenes, and she's, like, seems so relaxed in this movie that sounds like such a nightmare to do. Like, that's, like, really inspiring to me. I find her, like,
yeah,
endlessly is, fascinating in that
no,
way.
No, yeah, and she's in one of the most problematic shooting schedules slash situations of her life, and she's just fine.
She's cool just, like, about it.
Calm.
It's unbelievable. You know, like, I just think, like, directing is a very stressful job, as we all, I'm sure, can imagine. And directing mm-hmm. in those circumstances, the worst.
It'd be a nightmare.
Yeah. Oh, it's the worst, you know? You got a camera guy going down from, like, heat stroke and, like...
Yeah.
I'd turn into Werner Herzog by, like, day three and be threatening to shoot the star.
Right, exactly.
Chop somebody's leg off.
What is film?
Cannot what film is, in these conditions any longer.
Is your life not just a cosmic joke? Yeah, but she seems pretty... she seems pretty, like... pretty relaxed and pretty in control in an effortless way, and that, I think, is admirable. And it's just a really, again, a really tight movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of very specific choices that were made.
Yeah,
that all come together to make the movie as effective as it is.
Yeah, I mean, I was saying to you before we had this podcast that I think this movie was like properly rated when it won the Academy Award, mm-hmm. and then kind of got underrated over time because it, you know,
yeah,
like people just sort of stopped talking about it and stopped thinking about it. And when I watched this, I'm like, damn, this movie's good. This is a really good movie.
There's an interesting footnote. In March of 2010, one of the people that the writer, one of the soldiers, he accused the production, U.S. Army bomb disposal expert Master Sergeant Jeffrey Sarver, filed a multimillion-dollar lawsuit against the Hurt Locker. His lawsuit claimed that he used the term Hurt Locker and the phrase war is a drug around the writer, and his likeness was used to create the character of James. And that defames him somehow. But here's the crazy thing. Just to remind you that, like, even though this is a small production, we're still Hollywood folks. So the lawsuit was thrown out because entertainment lawyers said, quote, soldiers don't have privacy. And Bull argued that it was just based on a bunch of soldiers, guys. Like, he just, that's what he said. So Sarver had to pay Summit Entertainment $180,000 in lawyer's fees. So here's a soldier who's claiming, like, you kind of built it on my shoulders, and Summit Entertainment, this well-known production house, you know, like, how can you give me some money, or, like, how you just kind of took this from me. And they're just like, nah, we're just going to take it from you.
I think the ruling soldiers don't have privacy.
That is crazy.
A pretty striking ruling.
And that is a quote. That is literally a quote. That is something the entertainment lawyers actually said in court. Is that because they're soldiers, they don't have privacy. People can just witness them. That's why we don't have, you know, likeness waivers when we do the news on wars, which is true. They don't do that. But it's just kind of heartless. And
Bull had specifically gotten permission, I think, from the government to do whatever he decided to do with the results of his.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention that just because I thought it was interesting that, like, we're building this, you know, kind of narrative that Hurt Locker is this, like, scrappy young...
Yeah, but it's still... You
know, it's still Hollywood.
Still a movie.
You know, and it's very good film.
They're going to keep their money, though.
Right.
They're going to
They got some bodies buried. They got some bodies buried out back.
Yeah.
Oh, it wouldn't be a Hollywood movie if they didn't.
You want to sue us? You're going to pay. That's how the movie was made. Let's get into some observations, huh, Tom?
Yeah.
In a segment we like to call Hidden Bullshit.
Secret thing. Okay, so this may be a stretch, but this is something I was trying to work out with the stray cats that you keep seeing. The first one is the most striking.
Yes.
But we see two different shots of two different stray cats, both of which are like emaciated and like mangy and just beat up. And then the first one in particular has a bum leg. Like it's not walking on its front.
Three pod.
But it's still like trucking along and like it's not behaving like it's hurt or anything. And neither is the other one. They're just, you know, beat to shit, but still operating as best they can. And I think in addition to just being like a striking image, that's a metaphor for both our three main characters and then also the Iraqi civilians that are in the movie.
Yeah.
Because the three main characters are all broken in different ways, but they're still, you know, they're still doing their job. And
still being a cat.
Still soldiering on, still catting along.
Yeah.
And then the same thing with the civilians that we see. They're in this busted ass, poor war zone. And they're still like, you know, the kid, Beckham, is like, he's playing soccer, selling his DVDs, and like everybody, you know, they're still, you know, when James runs into the city, there's still like a nightlife and like people are just eating out or like, you know, at a hookah bar. So people are still trying to
live their life.
They're still living, even though this the hell that they're in, you know,
he runs into that bizarre professor's house.
Right, who like was expecting a CIA agent.
Yeah, he's like, I'm very pleased that you're here, CIA agent. But I think that was more of a statement about like, this is how an intelligent person deals with this situation, because he's you could kill me at any second, and since we know he's a professor, we know he's got some intelligence, his go-to response is, I'm very happy you're here, just to defuse any situation.
He takes control of that situation almost immediately.
Yeah.
Which is another
wife or daughter, I'm not sure.
I think it was his wife.
Who's
upset about it. Yeah.
Chases him the hell out of the house.
I thought it was interesting because I had a slightly different read, but the same kind of analogy, which I thought the character of Beckham, which is the boy who sells the DVDs, serves as an analogy for the war itself. At first, James befriends him, making him all about like, hey, I'm going to help you out and you're, you know, like,
I'm cool
going to give
soldier.
Money. So like so what that chapter is, it's all about aiding the local population, right? Then Will doesn't recognize whether or not Beckham's dead because he thinks that a different boy is Beckham. So he can't even recognize him. And that to me represents the nonlinear warfare that like plagued the conflict. The idea of like that guerrilla warfare of like, who's my enemy? Who's friend? Who's foe? But also kind of informs kind of the racist undertones of what's going on in the film.
He literally can't.
Yeah, and he can't tell
the children.
Well, I think the film also slightly implies we can't either.
Yes, which
right, that there's they place enough doubt. I haven't checked, so I don't know if they actually used the same actor.
Yeah,
on
that
the
would
table,
be
but
really
they disguised the boy enough. And James's response is so immediate, and he's so sure that it's the same kid, even though they cut back to Sanborn and Eldridge, and Eldridge's like, is that the same kid? Sanborn's like, no, man.
They can't tell.
Is that what he says?
Yeah,
oh,
he says, no,
man.
It's not the same kid.
No, it's not the same kid.
And then, I think Eldridge then backs it up by saying, are you sure? And then Sanborn's like, no.
Right.
Like, yeah.
So, in the end, that's why that didn't stick out to me.
None of them know.
But he's just...
Well, I mean, also, in the defense of all of us poor American racists over here, that is such a jarring concept, the idea of putting a bomb in a dead child.
Oh, yeah.
That, like, it's very hard to do the work of looking at that kid and making sure it's not it's not a different child.
But, yeah.
That's a lot going on at once
true.
Emotionally.
And they only show his face, I think, twice.
And it's always upside down. I don't think he's oriented in our direction.
He has a gigantic wound on the side of his face.
Yeah, so intentionally.
Yeah, it's intentionally sort of disfigured him. But they give you the interesting question whether or not James would have, because he's going to blow up the whole building. And then he decides
he's
not
demo
to because he's like, fuck this, I have to take this kid out of here. So he reaches into the kid and takes the bomb out and defuses
it. Which
is
the worst,
carries the kid outside. Only to later find out that it wasn't the kid he thought it was.
Right.
Would he have demoed the building if it was just some random boy that he didn't recognize?
Yeah.
Seems like he would have.
Seems like he was emotionally.
I don't know.
Well, that's the thing that I thought so in this narrative that I'm building, in the end, Beckham returns with the say, hey man, want a DVD after all this has happened. And when James is walking to Eldred's helicopter, James gives him the cold shoulder. It's like he never helped him at all. So emotionally, James doesn't know how to deal with the conflict, so he just ignores it. He's just like, I don't know what happened. I'm just going to ignore it. Much in the same way that America kind of did when it realized it didn't know if it should be in Afghanistan or Iraq. So at the end of the film, when Sanborn asked, How do you take the risk? James responds, I don't know, I just don't think about it. So there's no answer to why James thinks that he is the way he is. James, in the moment, personifies American involvement in the war.
I loved that. I read that a little bit ago, and I loved it. I agree. I think he's embarrassed mm-hmm. of having gotten something wrong.
Sure.
When he doesn't talk to that kid, which that feels right.
That
I think
feels
he's
right.
embarrassed about his own vulnerability.
And because he threatened somebody. Like he took that other guy yeah. who he was working with and like drove him at gunpoint into the yeah. middle of a town and then like invaded a professor's home.
He just broke into a house.
Right. It's like basically the one time he tried to be a hero, every single thing he did was wrong. You know what I mean? Like the one time he like tried to do something actually heroic and selfless instead of, I think you can argue he was mostly selfish when he's defusing
those
bombs.
He's primarily selfish when he's defusing the bombs.
The one junkie. Selfless act he does kind of ruins at least many people's nights, if not some lives.
I think it has something to do with the duality of the character as well, because we see that he can't operate at home. He's completely alien at home.
Yeah, yeah. He can't deal with buying cereal.
No, that situation confounds him.
That like was a great shot of that cereal.
Yeah. When it's just the wall.
Well, it just looks horrible, and it's like lit with fluorescent lights, so it looks overwhelming and gross.
It's just this endless wall and all like the psychotic faces of the mascots. It's just like he's just grabs one in disgust and throws it, and the scene opens. He's literally lost in the supermarket.
Yep.
Evangeline Lilly.
He doesn't know where the cereal is.
Yeah, she just leaves, gets some cereal, and he's like fucking lost. He has no idea how to get.
Yet when he's got a bomb suit on, defusing a bomb, he is totally
at home. Yeah,
clarity.
Yeah,
total clarity.
Yeah, and it's like while he's in the war zone, that's his home life. Like that's where he's himself. That's where he's comfortable. So he's like inventing, I guess, a reason to care. I guess with Beckham, where he's like, okay, this is a child I can care about. Because, like, his son's picture is just in the box with a bunch of his detonators. Like, they have the same level of importance in his mind, his child and all the detonators, the bombs that almost killed him.
We could be meant to take from this situation how poor of a father he is.
Yeah.
Like, the way that he deals with the Beckham thing is sort of also him slowly realizing that he shouldn't.
Well, I think
have a child, that he shouldn't be a father, that he shouldn't try to do this.
It's that he opened himself up to be like vulnerable about this kid. And then, I think what you said is probably he's embarrassed about it, but it's also, he decided to be vulnerable, right? He decided to be heroic, but he ends up rescuing a kid that he winds up not knowing. And then the first thing he does after that is he tries to save the guy that has the bomb manacled to him in the middle of the town square. That is the only selfless bomb defusal thing we do in the movie.
That's true.
And he ultimately, when it comes down to the wire, like he's telling Sanborn, get out of here because I'm going to blow up. You know, I'm going to try to cut this thing. I got to get this off this guy. But then ultimately, when it gets down to it, he can't do it.
No, he can't.
He can't get blown up for somebody else. Like he can't say he was not able to save that guy, and he was not willing to die trying.
Yeah, boy, that's a really anti-hero version of this character. But I think that's what we're looking at here.
I think he still is an anti-hero. He just he does good things, but it's only when it's in service of himself.
Right. Like he's a tool that's useful.
Yeah.
But profoundly broken.
Well, yeah. But and that leads into the other thing that I was going to say is. The three main characters are a family unit. James is the father, Sanborn is the mother, Eldridge is the kid. And it's, you know, James, he's the father figure. He's emotionless, pretty
much.
He's kind of, he calls all the shots. I mean, he shouts the other two down. He's not a good father figure, but he is the father. He leads, you know, he makes all the decisions. He doesn't regard the other two's emotions in his decision-making or their voice in his decision-making. And then later on, he's like, you know, like fun and like chummy with them, but it's like he's in charge and I don't give a damn what you think, and he makes terrible decisions and forces them into it. Sanborn is just trying to keep everybody safe.
Yeah, and navigate his own terror in some ways, right?
Right.
Because they're not the same guys after that accident in the beginning.
No, they break. Yeah. They flip.
Yeah.
But yeah, Sanborn's very much the motherly figure because he's concerned about everyone's safety and their emotional reaction to things and protocol, and like this is the necessary things you have to do to be a team. You have to keep talking to me. Like, you know, when James throws his headset away, Sanborn punches him. He's like, don't ever do that shit again.
Yeah. Which, when you realize the rank problem here, which I would say in some ways
they're both sergeants.
Yeah, right, but I think James outranks him.
I think he's staff sergeant. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that there's that, and then Eldridge is obviously the kid because he's in emotional turmoil. He's like kind of like a moody teenager. I mean, he's seeing a therapist.
For sure.
He's like, he doesn't know how to deal with the feelings that he's feeling. He's really obsessed with death. And then the end of his arc becomes when
he also literally is playing Gears of War.
He's literally playing Gears of War. And he's clearly the youngest out of them. And his arc ends when he finally lets himself get angry at James.
Yeah,
like when he finally yells at his dad and tells his dad to fuck off. You've ruined, look what you've done to me. Look what you've done to me and mom.
Yeah.
And then Sanborn breaks when, you know, after that night. It's after the guy in the square.
Yeah.
It's after the guy
like
in the square.
He wants to get out of the army.
He says, I want to get out of the army and I want to have a kid. And earlier in the film, remember, Sanborn is adamant that he doesn't want to have
a
kid.
Yeah.
I'm not ready to have a kid.
Yeah.
But now he's like, this, I just want to get out and I just want to have a kid. And then James is what we just discussed, where he tries to be emotionally available and finds out that he is incapable of doing it. He just can't do it.
And that change happens pretty quickly for him, or like that discovery happens pretty quickly for him, because he's only at home for like 10 minutes in this movie.
Well, I think it begins with the Beckham stuff.
Right. It's
the
leading
Beckham stuff, the guy in the square, and then when he's finally back at home. And then the home is when he realizes it. He just flat out tells his son, you're not the most important thing in the world to me.
Yeah.
So
thank God you don't understand my human words.
Right.
So that this won't
you're just a tiny infant baby.
So that you'll have to figure out that I meant this years from now in therapy.
When you're 15, you're going to hate me for an entirely different reason because you're not going to remember this.
Okay, so we're going to segue to a segment that talks about the scenes that would have enhanced or ruined the plot for you in a segment we like to call bonus scenes that should have existed. So in James's box of things that almost kills him, there's a battery from the first op that we see in the film. Like their first, in fact, he actually says this is the first time, like the relay, I think is what he calls it. And if you remember, that battery showed up earlier in the film because it was against the wall. There's a piece of wire. It's the one where he pulls up
the spotter was going to connect it to that empty wire to blow up all those.
You kind of piece it together. If he's going to run over there, he would just attach the battery. Mm-hmm. It would all explode. And that's like the backup detonator. Now, when you witness the bomb maker run away, they like catch each other's eyes and he like holds up.
He holds up the fuse, or
the
what would
fuse,
make it
yeah,
go,
and he's like,
basically.
Gotcha. And then right at that moment, the bomb maker throws the battery on the ground. So it's like 30 feet away from him at this point. Now, we now know that he has this on his person. He put it in his box. But in that scene, he heroically like walks away after he says, we're done. So that meant that at some point, Renner's character James walks back to grab the battery.
Like, trots over.
Which is just such a silly thing to be like,
guys.
We're done. Walk. I'm so cool. Oh, I gotta get a battery.
You just want to hang on that same shot.
Yeah.
And he walked away like, and then like, right, and he comes back.
I gotta get my little.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That's solid.
You got one?
I did. So when James abandons the base to go hunt down, I guess Beckham's family is what he's looking for.
Yeah, or whoever.
Avenge Beckham out in the streets of Iraq. He gets let back in the base after a night of basically failure. And the soldier
assaulting
that's,
civilians.
Yeah, right. The soldier that's frisking him and sort of recognize him, and he's like, you know, what were you doing out there? And he's like, I was visiting a brothel. And the guy says, like, I'll let you back in as long as you tell me about that brothel. So then we should just have a scene of that guy trying to find that brothel.
Right, James, like, because he says, okay.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Just to get in. So he says, like, so where is it? And he's like, well, it's on, like, 4th and, you know.
Right, exactly.
And then he goes in there and he's like, this isn't a brothel.
Some dude wandering around like, whoa.
Maybe he sent him right back to that professor's house and the professor was equally eager to meet that guy.
equally diffused that situation. Oh, a CIA agent.
Did you guys read that as he was diffusing the situation? That's
how
you read that?
That's how I
read
that.
That as he was doing everything he needed. Like, he didn't care if, like,
that's
he
a
just
very,
needed to get in.
That's a correct and generous interpretation of it. I interpreted it like I took it at its face value. Like,
oh,
maybe
he
is actually he
really
interested
was?
In this guy. Or, like, that he was, like, suspicious in an unknown way.
No, it's just Bomberman diffusing the situation.
I think that was just that guy shutting James down.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah. But that's definitely where that guy went to look for that brothel.
Shucks.
Another weird, real quick, this just occurred to me with the family dynamic thing. The scene where he diffuses the bomb in the car in front of the UN building.
Yeah.
And he takes off his earphones. That scene is mom and dad fighting.
Yes.
And Eldridge is relaying messages between mom and dad.
Yeah.
That is what's
going on. And he's unsure of what to do.
Because mom and dad are fighting.
Well, also I use this word gently, I hope. He's being nagged too. Like he's literally being nagged. Come on, we got to get out of here. We got to go. Right?
With
like
the sensible thing to do.
It is the sensible thing to do.
Nobody's life is at risk anymore.
100%, but it definitely reinforces those roles.
Right. Yeah. You know? He's being nagged, so he takes his earphones
off. There's still
a
hierarchy, you know. Yeah. So it's like whether or not he's being quote-unquote nagged, he can't do anything about it. At one point, he actually says, like, yeah, it's not going to happen. When he's like, make him put those headphones back on.
Well, yeah, no, he
and
can't.
And he's just like, I don't think it's going to happen.
Ranking officer. He can't make him do it.
He can't do anything.
Any more than a little boy can make his father do something.
Right, right.
True.
So we watched the movie. Let's make some observations you may not have heard of. Basically.
It might not have occurred to you.
Yeah, non-intuitive arguments about things in the movie. We're calling this segment, Let's Overthink It.
After Ralph Fiennes gets killed, after he just fucking unceremoniously just gets shot through the chest and dies instantly, the British guys do not speak or move for the rest of that sequence. And shit is still happening.
Yeah.
Like, they send Eldridge to look for more sniper ammo. One of the British dudes would know where that ammo is. But they don't say a word. They don't move to help him. They just, like, James has to say, check the dead guy. So he starts, like, frisking Ralph Fiennes finds the bullets and has to wash the bullets off. They're all being held down by the sniper, but the British dudes don't do anything else to help. They don't help Eldridge kill the guy on the bridge looking at them.
Well, that's in the sheep, right?
They're mercenaries, right? They're just straight up, like,
I think
at
so.
One point, Ralph Fiennes, before he dies, mentions... a bounty.
Yeah, so, 500,000 pounds, so he runs and shoots those guys.
Even though he argues they're on the same side, we're unsure of whether or not they're just headhunters.
They definitely lost their will. Like something happened there.
Well, they're like a hive mind.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Ralph Fiennes was their queen.
Right.
He was the Independence Day mothership.
Yeah, and he's without a task now.
And Will Smith exploded him, and now they can't work anymore.
Gave him a virus.
They stopped working.
As pointed out by a friend of the site in his 10-minute video that we've run, and that video is called The Most Realistic War Movie is Full of Shit, Christian Ramirez, who served in the military, mentioned that when James pulls out the 155 millimeter shells out of the ground via just one wire.
He just yanks them up, yeah.
He just yanks them out. Those each weigh 100 pounds. So that's like 600 pounds that he's...
Dude is deadlifting 600 pounds.
With one arm.
Yeah.
Also, you can't pull bombs out like that, as you would expect, because in this day and age, they commonly have sensors for that kind of thing.
So you would think.
Immediately fire off.
So I wanted to mention that the Sergeant Bo Bergdahl story, which was the subject of the second season of Serial, that podcast, I mention it because right around the time that this movie came out in the United States, which was 2009, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl left his base, similar to how James does in the movie. And this was in Afghanistan, not Iraq, so those are different situations. But he was captured by...
The Taliban, right?
By the Taliban, I believe.
Was it ISIS?
I think it was the Taliban.
Okay.
And held hostage for 5 years. And we ended up having to exchange POWs for him, and it was a massive nightmare.
And it still hasn't resolved. Like, they're still deciding whether or not he's going to go to prison.
Yeah, they still are deciding that. People thought that maybe President Obama would pardon him. He didn't.
He super didn't.
And that was interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, the reason I bring it up is because the consequences of somebody leaving a military base are way more significant than they were treated in this movie.
Mm-mm.
Like, I made that joke about the brothel earlier. There's no way that James gets back on that base without going through the brig, probably some very serious...
He went AWOL.
Yeah, that's very, very serious. There would have been a massive military like signal and response to that situation.
Because more than just that one guy who frisks him saw him come in.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a bunch of searchlights and stuff.
Yeah, there were a lot of dudes guarding that gate.
Maybe they all really wanted that brothel.
They all went to the brothel
That
together.
Brothel ticket, yeah. They all wanted...
Sweet, sweet... brothel ticket.
Sadly disappointed.
Yes, they were. But on the front of, like, is this movie a realistic depiction of the military, the Bo Bergdahl story certainly poked some holes in his leaving the base.
Yeah, that's probably the most damaging one.
But what's cool about it is Mark Bowles, the screenwriter of of the Hurt Locker also was the one that interviewed Bo Bergdahl. This is what you told me, correct?
Right, yeah, yeah. He did
second season of Serial.
Season of Serial is all based on Mark Bowles' research. He has something like 25 hours of interview, which he was going to develop into a movie about Bo Bergdahl with Kathryn Bigelow, which may still happen, but they pushed it back to do Detroit, which just came out.
Yeah, but that's pretty cool.
So that is cool.
Yeah.
So we're done here, but we wanted to talk about how you can talk to us. So check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Cracked Movie Pod. Please hit us up with your thoughts, people. Yeah, we want to hear them. We've been Abe, Tom, and Adam. Adam, where can we find you online?
You can find me at The Real Gans on Twitter, also on Instagram, if you're lucky.
If you're lucky. I'm lucky.
You were very lucky. Friend. You know about it.
All right. Good to know. We've been honored you've joined us.
Thank you,
my friend.
Yeah, yeah.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Next week, we'll be back talking about Zero Dark Thirty, continuing our Bigelow month. There'll be four. And if you're in LA this Saturday, September 9th, come see us dissect Point Break at the live Cracked podcast at UCB Sunset with guests Soren Bowie and Carmen Angelica.
I think there's going to be a link to buy tickets in the description.
Come see us in person.
Yeah.
They're very impressive in person.
Yeah.
Like they glow a lot. You'll like it.
It's very imposing. It's very difficult to be in the same room as Abe. We have to leave the door open and
just all the glow.
Lots of windows.
Yeah, the radioactive glow.
The joy and the charisma is just overpowering. But you'll enjoy that.
Well, commenters, tweet or Facebook message us about what directors you want us to cover. We listen. That's it. Watch on, movie people.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to that episode, and we want to thank Mack Weldon Underwear for sponsoring it. With a smart design, premium fabrics, and a simple shopping experience, Mack Weldon Underwear is definitely better than whatever underwear you're currently wearing. In addition to looking and feeling great, all Mack Weldon products are crafted with natural fibers that have built-in performance capabilities, so they work hard too. They even have a line of silver underwear and shirts that are naturally antimicrobial, which means they eliminate odor. All that, and they're shipped right to your door. You don't even have to leave your house to buy underwear. If you don't like your first pair, you can keep it, and they'll still refund you, no questions asked. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your purchase using the promo code MOVIECLUB. Once again, go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your purchase using the promo code MOVIECLUB. Super Ego fans, there's a new bonus episode for you on Stitcher Premium. In this new episode of Super Ego Cinema, Dr. Jeremy Carter, Dr. Matt Gourley, and special guest Chris Tallman provide the commentary for the 007 classic The Man with the Golden Gun from an undisclosed studio deep in purgatory. Plus, Stitcher Premium also gives you access to the entire Super Ego archive, Super Ego Forgotten Classics, and two more episodes of Super Ego Cinema. Just go to StitcherPremium.com/SuperEgo and use promo code CRACKED at checkout to get a one-month free trial. That's StitcherPremium.com/SuperEgo and use promo code CRACKED.
Hi, everybody. Chris Gethard here from Beautiful Anonymous. Wanted to let you know about an episode of my show. It's pretty unusual because as a co-host, Katie Couric, which you may not expect because I tend to do really dumb things.
Well, I have like a weird emotional attachment to Chris just because I've watched, you know, people eat burritos off of his belly.
Now, Katie doesn't know what that refers to, and you're making me look real crazy. Now you're putting the screws to me.
I'm sorry, Chris.
Once did an episode of my TV show where they built a burrito on my belly and ate it. It was called the Belly Burrito. And
I'm really hungry, so right now that sounds incredibly appealing to me.
Well, it'll make you not hungry. Well, thanks for throwing me under the bus on that one, Amelia. Making me look bad for like Katie Couric. Thanks so much for putting up with me being in your feed right now. Maybe you check out the episode and maybe you dig it. Maybe you dig it so much you subscribe to Beautiful Anonymous on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you listen. All right, thank you so much. I'll stop bugging you.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.